Brexit.
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 Get Brexit done.
Today on Vox Talks Economics, how is Brexit changing the UK economy? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram as well. On the 27th of April 2022, UK and a Changing Europe ran a one-day conference called The Economics of Brexit. What have we learned? Or what indeed, it's now a year and a half since Boris Johnson got Brexit done, to quote the campaign slogan from the last UK general election. So now we can look at both policy and data to see if the promises of or fears for Brexit were nearer the mark. CEPR is publishing an e-book about the conference with contributions from the speakers, and I'm going to speak to three of them today. One of them, of course, is Jonathan Portes of King's College London and CEPR, who organised the conference. He described the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, what we know as the Brexit Agreement, as the biggest changes to UK policy in 40 years. So I asked him, what does it change about the UK that interests economists?
The Trade and Cooperation Agreement essentially takes the UK out of the single market for goods and services. It doesn't impose tariffs and quotas on trade between the UK and the EU, but it does reintroduce all those regulatory barriers that the single market takes away between member states of the EU and indeed between the EU and some other countries like Norway and to some extent Switzerland. So it also takes the UK out of the European Customs Union. So what it means is there are all sorts of checks on goods that go between the UK and the EU. It means that the regulatory systems between the UK and the EU are no longer aligned, so both sides have in principle to make sure that goods travelling across the borders conform to their own standards as well as the standards of the place that they're coming from. And it also introduces various barriers to trade and services.
Now, there was a time when we talked about almost nothing apart from Brexit, not so much in the last couple of years for obvious reasons. What was the intention of the conference?
It is far too soon to make a comprehensive assessment of the long-term impacts of Brexit, but we do have more than a year of data on trade and migration flows. And despite COVID and other things, there are always other things, we can still look at the data. We have seen lots of anecdotal evidence of the impact of Brexit. The idea of this conference was to look and see, given what data we have, given the studies that economists have been doing so far, what can we conclude about the impact of this major change in the trading arrangements between the UK and the EU? Is it having an impact? If so, is that more or less what we expected, theoretically, or from our models and forecasts? Or are there things in the data that surprise us?
But with COVID-19 to mess it up, as you said, and some transitional arrangements still in place, is it maybe a little bit too early to say anything definitive about what's happened with Brexit?
It's clearly too early to say anything definitive, but then you can say that about almost any event in economic history. People are still arguing vigorously on my Twitter timeline about things like the impact of slavery on the development of industrial capitalism in the US, for example. So no doubt they'll be doing that on whatever succeeds Twitter in 50 or 100 years when it comes to Brexit. But obviously, COVID has shaken things up, and obviously that does confuse things. But nonetheless, the advantage of COVID from this point of view was that it was something of a global shock. It hit many advanced economies in quite similar ways in terms of the sort of sectors that were affected. So I think that particularly when we look at some of the detailed patterns of trade and migration, and we see things that are different to the pre-Brexit period in the UK in a way which they're not in other countries, it's not unreasonable to conclude, at least at a very high level, that Brexit probably has something to do with it.
Brexit.
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 Get Brexit done.
Next, I spoke to Thomas Sampson of the London School of Economics. He's taken an early look at the patterns for trading goods, and he's found as many questions as answers.
Disentangling what was due to Brexit from the effects of COVID was probably the main challenge we faced in doing this work. The way we tried to do that was to focus on how the UK's trade with the EU has changed both relative to the rest of the world and compared to how US and EU trade with the two regions have changed. So in that way, what we try to do is kind of separate the effects of Brexit, which we think are primarily specific to trade with the EU, from COVID, which is more of a global shock. And that allows us to estimate how bilateral openness between the UK and the EU has changed, controlling for shocks to supply conditions in exporting countries and demand conditions in importers.
Before the agreement was signed, but after the vote, how did the idea of an impending Brexit disrupt trade with the EU?
Interestingly, we don't find strong evidence of anticipation effects. So we don't find that the UK's trade kind of reoriented away from the EU before the TCA was introduced. So we don't see much evidence of those kind of impending Brexit effects having large impacts on trade.
So then after that agreement was signed, how did the value of our exports to the EU change?
In the very first quarter of the TCA, so the first quarter of 2021, we find a sharp drop in exports to the EU. And, you know, that's probably not surprising. If you recall, the TCA was only actually agreed 8 days before it came into effect. So firms really had very little time to get their heads around what this new trade agreement meant. And unsurprisingly, therefore, there was this kind of drag on trade in the first quarter. But then we actually find a strong bounce back in trade for the rest of 2021. And in the second half of the year, we don't find any evidence that there's a persistent decline in exports to the EU relative to exports to the rest of the world. So UK exports seem to have actually held up pretty well in the first year.
But I have been watching a year of news reports where they interview firms and they say that trade barriers and red tape have just made it uneconomic for them to export to the EU. Is this not true?
I think that's a really important question, and it gets to the heart of what we end up finding. Despite the fact that we don't find much evidence of a decline in the value of exports, I certainly wouldn't take away from our research the idea that exports have been unaffected by the TCA. And in fact, when we dig more into the data and look at it kind of a little bit of a more disaggregated level, we find very clear evidence that there has been a big shock to what's going on with exporters. And in particular, we look at the number of trade relationships between UK exporters and EU importers. And there we see that the introduction of the TCA coincides with a very sharp drop, maybe around 30% on our measure, in the number of trade relationships. And interestingly, that decline is driven by low-value relationships being destroyed. We don't at this stage observe the firm-level data, so we don't know exactly which firms are driving these changes. But our results are certainly consistent with the idea that the TCA has created new fixed costs of exporting, and this has led many small firms to stop exporting to the EU, while the larger firms that drive aggregate values have been able to absorb these costs and continue exporting. But we're seeing potentially evidence that this has been really bad news for smaller exporters.
Look at it the other way. What's happened to the volume of imports coming to the UK from the EU?
For imports, the picture is a bit clearer, in that we find an immediate and persistent decline in UK imports from the EU relative to the rest of the world in 2021, so once the TCA is introduced. And, you know, we estimate that there was around a 25% decline in EU imports due to the TCA. So there seems to have been a big drop in imports coming from the EU.
Why is that? Because we are still in a phase-in period for the new regulations. You wouldn't expect such a big effect.
We also were a little surprised to see bigger effects for imports relative to exports, given that, as you say, the UK has been phasing in the new import controls. One thing this shows is clearly that the controls that have been introduced and then the knowledge that other controls will be introduced in future has led to importers shifting their demand away from the EU. That said, why there is this asymmetry between the import side and the export side is at this point a little bit of a puzzle, something we hope to look at in future research, but it is sort of something to note and ponder further.
Clearly, there's a lot still to find out, and it's early days yet. But do you think that Brexit has permanently changed the type of goods trade that there will be between the EU and the UK?
That's certainly my expectation. I think it will take several years, maybe up to a decade, for the full effects of Brexit on UK trade to become clear. But these new barriers, the new customs checks, the regulatory barriers that have been introduced, they're not temporary features of the new relationship. They're going to be here permanently, and therefore they're likely to lead to a permanent hit to UK-EU trade. How big that hit is still remains to be seen, but already in the first year, we certainly see evidence that trade has started to reorient itself.
Brexit.
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 Get Brexit done.
Of course, the UK also imports and exports a lot of services, particularly financial services. To find out what happened to that trade, I spoke to Sarah Hall of the University of Nottingham. She's the author of the chapter on post-Brexit financial services arrangements. I asked her, first of all, how big was the financial services trade pre-Brexit, and what was the arrangement under which those services were supplied?
The best date to look at that is to look at 2019. So that's before Brexit and before COVID. And at that point, by the end of 2019, we know that the EU made up about 40% of UK financial services exports.
Whoa.
And 32% of UK financial services imports were coming from the EU. So we had a significant trade surplus in financial services with the EU. And this was based on single market membership for the UK, and specifically something called passporting. So passporting allowed financial services firms to use their base in the UK, very often in London, but not exclusively in London, to service EU clients without needing to open another office in Paris, Frankfurt, Amsterdam. So in a way, the UK and particularly London became a hub for international firms wanting to sell financial services into the EU.
But the Brexit agreement's done away with passporting now, hasn't it? So what's replaced it? Has anything replaced it? And how much access to EU markets do UK financial services firms have?
When the UK left the single market, the EU was clear that the UK couldn't cherry pick aspects of the single market that were particularly beneficial for the UK economy, yeah, such as passporting. And so the UK now accesses EU financial markets through something called equivalence. Equivalence isn't the same as passporting, so it's not permanent. It doesn't cover the whole range of financial services activities, and it can be withdrawn by the EU with 30 days' notice. What's more significant is the EU has been very cautious in the areas of financial services that it's granted equivalence to the UK in. So at the moment, the UK is operating with one equivalence decision, and comparable markets in places like Singapore and the US would have kind of upwards of 15. So market access has been reduced, and it is now harder to export financial services from the UK into the EU than it was pre-Brexit.
I remember from 2016 onwards, this regular drip, drip, drip of news reports of financial services firms relocating entire business units, jobs out of London to various places in the EU. Do we have a final tally of how many jobs left the UK?
This is really interesting because the number of jobs that have moved, according to figures, are actually lower than some worst case scenarios would have predicted.
Oh.
Recent figures are suggesting around 7,000 jobs have moved from the UK to the EU. Some early estimates were closer to around 12,000. But I think the critical thing here is that this isn't the final figure. So firms have adopted a number of strategies to try and maintain EU market access, including moving the minimum amount of activity that they need to comply with EU regulations. What's interesting is that the EU and the European Central Bank are undertaking a number of reviews, including a desk mapping review, where they're looking closely at what job numbers and what sorts of activities they will expect to see taking place in the EU in the future. So there is some uncertainty about whether further jobs may need to move, and if so, when and to where. So I would treat that figure with a degree of caution. I think, though, on the other hand, there is some positive news for London and the UK in that the types of jobs that have moved have typically not been the very high value financial services market making jobs. They've often been in what might be termed mid or back office functions, so compliance or more kind of customer facing and sales type jobs.
Now, also back in London, the UK government published what it called the new chapter for financial services. That was July 2021. Does this new regulatory strategy, does it create opportunities perhaps for financial services in other locations outside the EU?
Yeah, so in the absence of equivalence, the UK has been clear that it wants to look at how it may streamline or regulate in ways that are better suited to the specifics of the UK market. And you're absolutely right that the new chapter in financial services and various speeches from the Chancellor Rishi Sunak have articulated this vision. At the moment, it doesn't look like wholesale rapid deregulation is the approach that they're taking. But there are some quite significant changes in particular parts of financial services. So, for example, changes in insurance regulation and changes to the regulators themselves in terms of them likely needing to consider competitiveness as part of their regulatory objectives. That was something we heard in the Queen's speech, anticipated in the upcoming financial services bill. It's also clear that as part of these changes, the UK is trying to develop trade with other non-EU partners. It's targeted so far the US and Singapore. And at the moment, there's a really interesting set of discussions going on about whether it could carve out and agree a mutual recognition agreement with Switzerland, which would allow very close and dense market access between those two jurisdictions.
What about other sectors within financial services? Maybe if London loses some share trading or derivatives trading or something like that, it can replace it with something else in which maybe it can become a global leader again. Is that possible?
In the policy frameworks which have come out of the government post-Brexit, it's quite clear that fintech, crypto and green finance are the sectoral areas that the UK is looking to develop leadership in. I think in fintech, there's quite strong grounds for UK leadership there. The UK was a pioneer in creating the regulatory landscape to facilitate fintech through what are called sandboxes, which the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, created. And those have been mimicked elsewhere globally. I think on green finance, there's a lot of interest in this, obviously not just in the UK. But in the UK, it was particularly given energy by the COP meeting in Glasgow late last year. Here, though, I think it's really important to note that in green finance, in some areas, the EU is quite a well-established global leader. It moved first in terms of developing what's called a green taxonomy, which is basically a set of guidelines as to what's going to count as green, with the aim of preventing so-called greenwashing. And so a really vital part of green finance. The UK has said that it's going to develop its own taxonomy. It's going to draw heavily on the EU's, which the UK contributed to when it was a member state. But I think if there's any duplication in taxonomy, so they look slightly different between the UK and the EU, that could lead to additional costs for firms if they're having to comply with both of those. So I think the UK needs to acknowledge areas where it does have genuine leadership potential and areas where international collaboration might be helpful.
Brexit.
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 Brexit. Get Brexit done.
But of course, it's what we call free movement if you're an economist, unrestricted immigration if you were a particular type of Brexit supporter in 2016, that was the most divisive issue of that referendum campaign. The narrative, which eventually led us to a hard Brexit, was that free movement for EU citizens was driving wages down in the UK and putting strain on essential services as well. The UK government promised an immigration system to take back control of its borders. I asked Jonathan Portes if that's the policy that the UK has now.
They have pretty much delivered the policy that they set out, at least in terms of free movement and economic migration. That is to say, the pledge was that free movement would end and it would be replaced for work purposes by a system that essentially treats people the same regardless of where in the world they're coming from. And that is broadly true, with the exception, for good historical reasons, of Ireland, which we still have free movement to and from Ireland. That predated the European Union, in fact. But apart from that, we do broadly treat people equally, regardless of where they're coming from, if they want to come here and work. And we do that on the basis of skill and salary. That is to say, if you want to come here to work in a job, you've got a job offer above a certain skill level and a certain salary threshold, you should be able to get a visa. And that is pretty much what the consensus was among Brexiteers, that the system ought to be post-Brexit. And that is indeed pretty much the system we have.
It's really worth measuring the impact of that. But do we have good enough data to measure this impact?
Well, I don't think we can talk about the economic impacts yet, but we can talk about some of the impact on migration flows. And so I described what the system looked like in conceptual terms. But of course, simply saying that there's a skill and a salary threshold doesn't tell you that much about the impact, because it could be a very, very restrictive system or a relatively liberal system. And in fact, here, this is one of the biggest surprises to me, and I think to many others, is that while the implication given by many Brexiteers was this would be a pretty restrictive system, and certainly the intention of Theresa May when she was Prime Minister that it would be an extremely restrictive system, that hasn't quite worked out.
Yes.
In fact, the system the government has introduced for various reasons, political and economic, is on the liberal side, probably more liberal than almost any system in the EU with regard to people coming from outside the EU. So roughly half the jobs in the UK labour market are open to anyone from anywhere in the world. That is to say, in most of the jobs that are, you know, in and around King's, not just professorships, but research assistants or whatever, I could in principle offer that job to somebody from Ireland, to somebody from India, to somebody from Indonesia. And if I was prepared to jump through a few bureaucratic hoops and pay a visa fee, they could come to that country and work in that job. So that's quite a liberal system.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what will be the economic impacts of that? I think it is very much too soon to say.
Yeah.
And that is the impacts on the labour market are very much clouded by COVID. But we can already see the impact on the numbers, where the number of people coming from the EU has fallen very significantly as a result of the end of free movement. And the number of people coming from outside the EU does indeed appear to have gone up quite significantly, particularly in sectors like health, where there's a huge demand for workers at the moment, and in the IT sector.
It's not all about GDP, is it? Do the current restrictions mean that we will be able to have enough staffing to maintain essential services for seasonal work? These sort of things dominate the headlines now, don't they?
That's right. I think that the government has moved a bit in response to some of these pressures. So, for example, it has expanded a quite generous special visa that applied to people coming to work in the NHS. That now applies to people coming to work in the social care sector, even people coming in relatively low paid occupations. So the government has moved a bit on that and made the system more liberal still. You still, however, one big sector which is certainly feeling the impact of this is what we call the accommodation and food services sector. That's bars, cafes, etc., where especially in London and some tourist-dominated areas, there was a very large presence of European staff. Those occupations are not eligible under the new system, and you can certainly hear some quite significant complaints coming from employers in those sectors. So it is certainly having an impact. But overall, I would say it's too soon to tell, but I think the economic impact of the changes to migration are certainly going to be considerably more positive than I and many other economists would have forecast 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, it's another potential impact, isn't there? Because with inflation running at 9% and a cost of living crisis, we might expect that wage demands would be quite strong. And if we have a fairly liberal immigration system, is that going to mean that there will be enough recruitment from overseas to hold down those wage demands? Will it have that effect?
I think it is too early to tell, but I mean, I think one thing that we've discovered over the last 20 years and has been emphasized in the last two is that what happens in the UK labour market is a lot more complicated than simply saying more workers overall or more workers in a particular sector
yes.
equals lower wages or vice versa. Somewhat to my and others' surprise, although wage growth is now quite strong, it's actually strongest in the finance and banking and IT sector rather than in the some of the low paid sectors that you might think would be most affected. Here, I think we would be very much premature to make a judgment. While I think it was reasonable to forecast that there would be some uptick in the relative wages of low paid workers, not perhaps a very large one, but some impact as a result of Brexit and the end of free movement, we're not seeing that yet in the data.
There was a time when more or less any economists who predicted a negative effect from Brexit, they were labelled with Project Fear. Perhaps the immediate economic impact of Brexit isn't quite as bad as what some economists feared.
Well, Project Fear refer to some of the more apocalyptic projections of immediate collapse in the wake of the referendum made by George Osborne and others for political reasons. And I think those were indeed exaggerated, somewhat irresponsible, and did not materialize. As regards the medium to long-term impact of Brexit, I think that what was presented at the conference shows that broadly the sort of impacts that we would expect are those that are materializing. New trade barriers, do reduce trade. There has been a positive impact on food prices resulting from the fact that we import a lot of food from the EU and it is more expensive to do so. There are lots of puzzles in the data. There's lots of stuff we don't understand. But at the moment, I'd say that what we've seen so far is broadly consistent with what economists forecast would be the medium and long-term impacts of Brexit. That is to say, you know, the metaphor, which I don't know whether I invented, but I always use, I probably borrowed it from someone else. Brexit is more of a slow puncture than a car crash. It will, over time, make us significantly poorer than we otherwise would have, but it's not going to be a catastrophe. We're not going to starve. We're not going to go backwards. And so far, at least, I'd say that that is pretty much what is happening.
Well, slow puncture, car crash, maybe even cruise control, you decide by downloading CEPR's free ebook. It is called The Economics of Brexit: What Have We Learned? This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week, we bring you the most important latest research. So if you want answers to the big economic questions of the day, we'll try to provide them if you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find more than 200 episodes as well. So whatever type of economics you like, there is a Vox Talk waiting for you.
Brexit. 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 Brexit.